Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Offshore wind seems to be having a bipartisan moment in New Hampshire, at least for now. Development is already underway in other coastal New England states, especially Rhode Island and Massachusetts. And here in the Granite State, supporters received a big boost this year when Governor Sununu asked the federal government for an offshore wind task force to study the feasibility of turbine development on our seacoast. Still, as we've learned with other large-scale energy projects, studying them is one thing, building them is another. And so today in The Exchange, we look at what's under consideration with offshore wind and what effects it could have on our economy, environment, and energy landscape. As always, we'd love to hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests in studio. Bill Quinlan is here, president and CEO of Eversource New Hampshire, the state's largest utility, serving 75% of the state's electricity customers. Bill Quinlan, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Yeah, great to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Bill White, managing director of ENBW North America. ENBW is a German wind developer that recently joined New Hampshire's renewable energy trade group, Clean Energy New Hampshire. And Bill White, good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Honored to be here.
Also with us, Annie Ropeek, NHPR reporter on energy, the environment, and the seacoast. Annie Ropeek, thank you for helping us out. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Annie, I want to turn to you first, but fold in everyone. Why do you think there's so much interest, Annie, right now in offshore wind?
Well, so this has been really building for several years now in New Hampshire, especially as we've seen some of our neighboring states take more of a kind of aggressive interest in offshore wind development, Massachusetts and Rhode Island especially. And, you know, we kind of watched for years as the Cape Wind project in Massachusetts kind of struggled to get off the ground. It was sort of a trial and error process that served as a bit of a model for, I would say, for the rest of the region. And so we're seeing that being built off of now. And New Hampshire sort of watched as that was all happening. Activists were pushing for this to begin the study of potential development, even back as far as Governor Maggie Hassan's administration, continued to do so under Governor Chris Sununu. And just early this year, he finally agreed to ask for this federal task force on offshore wind development, which is really the first step. So I think that, you know, offshore wind is having a moment internationally. I mean, it's really taken off in a lot of other countries. It's beginning to take off in the U.S. After a long time coming. And New Hampshire is surrounded by that kind of development, and I think is seeing opportunities there, not just in physical turbine development, but also in potentially manufacturing, being part of the supply chain, and is sort of seeing this as the last chance to get in on it or be left behind.
Well, and there's some federal tax credits, right, Annie, that support offshore wind. These expire pretty soon, so maybe that's why people are also moving quickly.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely behind a lot of the movement. Again, in our neighboring states, I think, you know, in New Hampshire, it's probably a little late for a literal project to take advantage of those just because the planning process, the development process takes years and years and years. So that is sort of spurring the climate that we're taking part in right now. But it's definitely going to be many years before we see any sort of bricks and mortar presence of offshore wind in this state. But I think we're starting to see the beginning of conversations about that happening.
Bill White, what do you think? What's behind all the interest right now?
Yeah, I think Annie actually hit it pretty well. Two things I would add, you know, obviously Governor Sununu and his outreach to the Department of Interior, which actually is in charge of federal land. So anything beyond 3 miles is federal waters. It's their leasing process. So that was obviously a big moment. But also there were 20 towns, communities along the South Coast who actually almost through a grassroots movement passed resolutions through their town meetings or their city councils to say, you know what, we want to explore this opportunity for offshore wind. And then on a more macro level, kind of beyond New Hampshire, is really the cost of offshore wind. that has been kind of the central kind of roadblock, I would say, for this new technology. Obviously, it has this economic development benefit. It obviously has this kind of this idea of New Hampshire-made energy is attractive, but the cost has always really been a bit out of reach. I think right now what we saw in the Massachusetts market with a competitive solicitation among three developers, we really got kind of a cost that, you know, as Annie mentioned, the Cape Wind project, almost three times lower than that project. So it really caught policymakers' attention up and down the East Coast. And I think that's why we're here at the table.
Where are the hot spots, Bill, for your company, ENBW, in terms of offshore wind in America?
Yeah. So, we're a company that obviously is based in Germany. We built the first commercial scale offshore wind project in Germany back in 2011. We have 1,000 megawatts under operation or under construction right now, and another 3,000 in development. When we look at the U.S. market, we are particularly focused in the Northeast. Right now, the two or three leading states, I should say Massachusetts. That's where I'm originally from. Unfortunately, we do not have a lease area there, but we are right now, our primary focus is New York and New Jersey, where both states have made significant commitments to offshore wind, 9 gigawatts in New York, 3.5 gigawatts in New Jersey. We're opening an office there, and we're expecting the federal government to do an auction for a site, a lease auction, sometime early next year. We're also out on the West Coast, where we have a partnership with a company called Castle Wind, a 1,000 megawatt project envisioned to be off of Morro Bay, middle South California.
Okay, and the most basic of basic questions. A gigawatt is a lot, right? I mean, usually when we talk about energy, we talk about megawatts. So a gigawatt is way more than that.
Yeah, it is a significant amount of power. So when we're talking about a gigawatt, Bill might be, my friend here might be better on the percentage of energy. But if you think about New England at peak load, New England, the entire electricity grid, I think we're built out to between around 28 to 30 gigawatts of power. So when we talk about, how offshore wind can play a role in there, Massachusetts is looking at 3.2, Connecticut is looking at 4 and maybe more. Rhode Island is looking, at the same number. But we're talking about maybe making it a part of the mix, not the entire load.
Bill Quinn, I'm going to bring you into your thoughts on what's driving the interest in offshore wind here in New Hampshire and more broadly in New England.
Well, certainly Bill hit one of the issues, which is price. I think, offshore wind at scale has become cost competitive to the market. So that's an important driver. I'd say the other factor are the very aggressive clean energy goals that the region has, particularly in the Northeast. I think we're going to lead the nation in achieving those goals. That's coupled with the retirement of our traditional generation fleet in New England, coal, nuclear, oil, and soon to be natural gas. Those generation plants that we've relied on for decades, many of them have been retired or are going to be retiring. And fundamentally, we have to replace that generation capacity with clean, renewable sources going forward.
So it's kind of a trifecta of...
It is. And, when you talk about hot spots, and I think Bill hit this, but the Northeast is clearly where the action is. I'd say New England and New York are leading the country in this space. The Gulf of Maine, which implicates New Hampshire, has very large untapped offshore wind potential. Some of the earlier studies have identified up to 65 gigawatts of offshore wind potential in the Gulf of Maine.
A gigawatt,
just for frame of reference, is 1,000 megawatts. So when Bill talks about all of the generation capacity in New England being 30,000 megawatts, that's 30 gigawatts. So contrast that to 65 gigawatts of potential in the Gulf of Maine.
So is it super windy off of the New England coast? Is that why you say, Bill Quinlan, that New England is such a hot spot?
It is. It's both the consistency and the intensity of the wind fields coupled with the relatively shallow water depths. That's what makes southern New England particularly interesting, because you can install these pedestals, turbine pedestals, to hold the facilities into the ocean floor. As you get to deeper water depths, you have to start contemplating floating turbine pedestals, which is something that the industry is working to develop as we speak.
Okay, go ahead, Annie, and we'll jump in there.
Well, I just wanted to put the numbers in sort of further context.
The megawatts and gigawatt
numbers?
Yeah,
so, So take your house, for example. You use on average 600 kilowatts a year. Mm-hmm. Is that right? So so that's just one person. A kilowatt, 1,000 kilowatts would be a megawatt. And then, oh, Bill is passing me some numbers. And then, and then 1,000 megawatts would be a gigawatt. And so Northern Pass, for example, Bill Quinlan's Eversource project would have been 1,200 megawatts of hydropower. So that's like 1.2 gigawatts. So these projects are massive, massive, massive. That's sort of the point that we're getting at. I mean, these would supply thousands, millions of homes worth of power, contribute huge amounts of power to the grid, and cover like large, large amounts of the overall fuel mix that we have now, which, you know, offshore wind and wind in general is not a big part of that fuel mix right now. But there's, as Bill Quinlan pointed out, a lot of retirements coming up, plants that are going to be closing, kind of space in that grid that's going to need to be filled. And offshore wind kind of is scalable to fill a lot of it with single projects.
Sure, Vermont Yankee shutting down, and I think
Pilgrim is shutting down this
right,
year.
So I want to invite our listeners to join us. We welcome your questions and comments about offshore wind and all the activity around it in New England these days. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So all of you, just a couple real basic questions. Bill White, where specifically off of New Hampshire's coast might be the best place to put turbines? You know, New Hampshire only has 17, 18 miles of coast. People go back and forth on that. But what are you guys looking at?
So I think we're not quite looking at it that granularly, shall we say. This is something that we, you know, prior to this role, I worked in the state of Massachusetts, and I kind of led this offshore wind process. And, you know, it's a federal process, but it's informed by states and states through their own stakeholders. And so it's really kind of a question and a decision really for the state of New Hampshire on exactly, you know, how far out do they want to be? You know, some folks are concerned about visibility issues. Every state has taken a different tack. New Jersey is about 7 miles off the coast. New York is, you know, around 20. Massachusetts, we're about those areas begin at about 14 miles off the coast. So, you know, this visibility issue is a concern for some people. And so, again, that's a part of the planning process. That right now what will happen, we believe, is that, you know, because Governor Sununu has kind of made this request to the Department of Interior, we would envision that they would do a task force. It's an intergovernmental task force where they have state and federal officials, as well as tribes and local communities, at the table to really begin to kind of have this conversation. What are our priorities? You know, what are the issues that we want to make sure that we deconflict, shall we say? And so I think that's kind of the beginning of the conversation. And it really will be driven by the state of New Hampshire, as well as probably the state of Maine, as well as the state of Massachusetts, all who have kind of interest in this region and in this area.
So we're not talking specifically about a project for 10 turbines near the Isles of Shoals or anything specific like that. We're looking at this federal task force and how it's going to inform where these things might go.
Exactly. I think that's really, it's kind of the planning process. There's no kind of preconceived outcome. It's a planning process where the federal government takes input from primarily from the state and others, and they determine really what are the state of New Hampshire's priorities. I guess the one other thing that I'll just add in is that, you know, you mentioned that the coastline of New Hampshire is a rather small coastline, no question about it, but that shouldn't inhibit New Hampshire's ambitions. If you look at the Massachusetts wind energy area, that wind energy area currently is serving, I think right now, three and possibly four states. It's serving Massachusetts, but that same area is going to serve Rhode Island, Connecticut, and some of those developers have now also bid into the New York wind procurement, which is ongoing right now. So if you think about an area kind of, let's say, in northern New England, what I would say, kind of an area that is large enough to sustain some competition, multiple developers, I think that's what we really want is competition. But you could see that if we do establish an area through the federal process, you could see areas serving southern Maine, New Hampshire, and northern Massachusetts.
What's Eversource New Hampshire's interest in this, Bill Quinlan?
Our interest is multifold. One is to advance a clean energy economy and generation mix for New Hampshire and New England generally. Secondly, we Eversource are partnered with Ørsted. Ørsted is the largest offshore wind developer in the world. So when Bill mentions the projects under development in New York, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts, we and our partner Ørsted are very actively involved in project development. In fact, we actually own several leases in the southern New England area. We have projects that are under contract with both Connecticut and Rhode Island, and hopefully we'll move through the siting and construction soon. We also operate a large portion of the transmission grid here in New Hampshire and throughout New England. And you know, bringing this offshore power onto the transmission grid in a reliable and safe way and at the right location on the grid is something we believe we bring particular expertise in. It makes for a very great partnership with Ørsted. I will add that, you know, Bill mentioned the federal process. The outcome of that federal process is the identification of lease areas, which would then be put out for a competitive solicitation to project developers. I would say there are a few factors that get to your point on where are those lease areas. I think water depth, wind speed, clearly important. Visibility, you know, be far enough off the coast where the aesthetic impacts are minimized, but not so far that it becomes cost prohibitive, because you do have to transmit that power from the generation source, the turbines, basically to land and then interconnect with the grid. So it's kind of a balance between those factors. You know, in Massachusetts, the projects are generally 15 miles offshore, and I think that's the right balance for Massachusetts. But this federal process will help to work that out for New Hampshire.
And it's federal, just to get really basic here, Bill, because after, what, 2-3 miles, the waters are considered
federal waters.
Federal waters. Yes. So three miles in, it's New Hampshire or Maine or whatever. But beyond that, it's federal. And that's where the vast majority of these projects are located. I'm glad you mentioned transmission. I did want to ask all of you about that, because when I think about offshore wind, 14, 20 miles off the coast, I think, wow, that's a lot of cable. You got to run, I don't know, under the ocean floor, I guess, to get the power to land. So everybody can jump in. But Bill Quinlan, to you first. How does that happen? How does the power get from 15 miles off the coast to the shore?
I think you hit the nail on the head. It's an array of transmission cables that are laid on the ocean floor and essentially bring it onshore into either an existing substation or a new substation that would then interconnect with the regional power grid. There's a lot of experience worldwide and here in the United States with underwater transmission cable development. If you get very far out to sea, we would use a different technology, basically a direct current technology. But if you're in that 15-mile range, we would use conventional AC or alternating current technology.
How big are these cables? 2 feet across, 10 feet across?
Yeah, I'll give
small.
You a sense.
Bill White's making a small circle. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, under a foot in diameter.
I see.
So it's not really a pipeline. It's just a cord, essentially.
It's a cable. Yeah. It is essentially a cable. Yeah.
How disruptive is it, Bill White, to lay the groundwork, so to speak, for that cable?
So a cable has to be buried. The standard is 2 meters. So the federal government requires that cable that is from that offshore substation to the land side location has to be buried, you know, let's say about 6 feet underground. That's obviously an important issue for fishermen, because they don't want to have their gear, you know, hung up on that cable. And so they want to make sure that cable is not going to interfere with their livelihoods. And so that's a big issue. But, you know, this is obviously done on a regular basis in Europe. You know, it's obviously in an ocean environment, so nothing is easy, but it's not impossible.
All right. Well, coming up after a short break, we'll talk more about the impacts, concerns about the fisheries here in New England, also some concerns about migratory birds and fish migration patterns. And we'll hear a lot more about the wind power potential off the coast of New Hampshire in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
I'm Jason Moon, host of the Bear Brook podcast from NHPR.
Join me for a live show at the Wilbur Theater in Boston on Tuesday, May 14th. I'll speak about how we produced Bear Brook, the controversial science that helped crack open the case, and how that science is changing criminal investigations all across the country. Get your tickets now at thewilbur.com.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the future of offshore wind in northern New England. And as we're hearing, there's a lot of interest right now in these developments around the region, including in the Granite State. We're finding out how offshore wind works, looking at the potential impact on our state's economy, environment, coastal communities, and energy landscape. And as always, let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are Bill Quinlan, president and CEO of Eversource New Hampshire, the state's largest utility. Annie Ropeek is here, NHPR reporter on energy, the environment, and the seacoast. And Bill White, managing director of ENBW North America. That's a German wind developer that recently joined New Hampshire's renewable energy trade group, Clean Energy New Hampshire. And all of you, just before the break, we were talking about the transmission lines that would carry the energy from pretty far off the coast, 7, 14, 20 miles, to the shore to put that electricity to use on land. And you all described the cables that would carry the power underneath, about 6 feet under the ocean floor, as Bill White described it. Our producer, Christina Phillips, spoke earlier this week with someone who has real concerns about offshore wind development. This is Ellen Gaethel. She's with Explore the Ocean World. She's a marine biologist, a member of the Town Conservation Commission in Hampton, on the board of directors of the New Hampshire Coastal Conservation Commission. And Ellen said she is worried about electromagnetic current harming fish migration patterns. Let's hear a little bit.
There's chances of DC current going right into the water. And there's also electromagnetic fields that are caused, and we don't have a good understanding yet. We do know that fish use electromagnetic sensors and magnetic sensors to determine their migrations, but we don't know exactly which frequencies, the details, and studies have to be done.
Again, that's Ellen Gaethel. She is with the Town Conservation Commission in Hampton on the board of directors of New Hampshire Coastal Conservation Association. Annie Ropeek, to her last point, more studies need to be done. Now, you and I spent a fair bit of time looking at some of these environmental concerns. What kind of studies have been done on the impact on fish?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, as Bill White and Bill Quinlan have mentioned, there have been plenty of these projects developed around the world, and there have been really serious environmental hurdles that those projects have had to leap in order to get built in their respective countries. And so they've had to rely on a lot of research. There, you know, is research that comes from the federal government and from coastal universities on birds, on bats, on fish populations. And also a lot of these projects do work directly with the fishing industry on sort of development compromises. And, you know, that's a work in progress. I mean, we just saw sort of a breakthrough in Rhode Island that the New Bedford fishing community kind of was able to come to the table with developers down there to really agree on, you know, how development was going to work, how it was going to impact them in sort of a way that I think was a little bit more egalitarian than maybe past projects had been. And they've also been doing that with the people that are protecting North Atlantic right whales, agreeing on times of year that they're going to be building. So they are looking at times of year for migrations, that kind of thing. But as Ellen points out, there's so much more work to be done. I mean, this is a new technology, relatively speaking, and that always means that, you know, for as much as we know, there's 10 times as much that we don't know. And so there's plenty more research that needs to be done.
Bill White, I'd love to hear from you too, either specifically on the fish migration patterns that Ellen Gaethel talks about, or more broadly about the environmental research that's needed. Mm. There are lots of projects in the UK, lots of projects in Denmark. You work for a German company. So what have we learned about environmental impacts, especially fish populations, in other countries that have developed offshore wind more robustly than we have?
Yeah. You know, many of the fishermen, I've been working with the fishermen, particularly out of the Port of New Bedford for the last decade, and many of them will be very direct with you to say, look, the fishery in Europe does not compare to the fishery in the Northeast. It is a much larger, more economically valuable fishery. So that's point number
here
one.
Here in this country, you mean?
Here in the U.S., and particularly here in the Northeast. You know, and particularly there's various species, the ground fisheries, the scallop fishery is an enormously lucrative fishery. So That's point number one. Point number two, though, and many fishermen will tell you this, you know, they are being impacted by climate change, and the stocks are migrating. We have obviously a collapse of the cod fishery, which many people believe is due to climate change and the warming of the Gulf of Maine. You can also talk about the lobster fishery. I think Governor Mills, from newly elected in Maine, has indicated 100% commitment to renewable energy by, I believe, 2050. And it's a lot of, in her messaging, was because of the lobster fishery and the impact that warming waters are having on the lobster fishery and how they're moving further north and further offshore, an enormously important economic driver for the state of Maine. So, yes, more research needs to be done, but we also have to keep in mind that we're talking about a resource here that can produce clean energy and help mitigate the impacts of climate change.
So people are making that trade-off point. Bill Quinlan, go ahead and then.
Yeah, I would just add a couple of points. One, you know, with respect to the underwater transmission lines, this is a proven technology. For example, we have run underwater cables across Long Island Sound to New York from Connecticut. We're in the process of installing one in Boston Harbor using a very similar technique. Later this fall, we anticipate installing our Seacoast Reliability Project, which will cross Little Bay here in New Hampshire between Newington and Durham, again, using what we think is a very environmentally conscious jet plow technique, which essentially creates a high-pressure water jet column within the sediment. You lay the cable and you allow the settlement to resettle. So this is a proven technology, but I do think your question about environmental impacts and impacts on fisheries is one that does require further study. I think the good news is it's getting a lot of attention in southern New England. You mentioned New Bedford. We're very active with our projects in Massachusetts. It's a very big issue for the Rhode Island fishermen, the fishermen on eastern Long Island, and in the port of New London, Connecticut. So this is something that we are working daily with commercial and recreational fishermen to approach these projects in a very balanced way. And I think New Hampshire and northern New England will learn from that research, will learn from those studies, will have the benefit of those learnings as we move forward with actual projects in this region.
Go ahead, Annie.
I just want to make a couple points. I mean, New Hampshire is in an interesting position because our fishing fleet, our commercial fishing fleet, is so small compared to that of states like Massachusetts and, the Pacific Northwest and that kind of thing. But they are a part of those larger fisheries, and they're, you know, working with the same resources. Our lobstermen here are fishing the same lobster as the sort of much more powerful lobstermen in Maine are fishing. And so New Hampshire it's going to be interesting to watch how sort of our small fishing fleet that has a little bit less clout than some of their neighbors are affected by the negotiation that their neighbors are doing with some of these big projects. And the other point I would make is the climate change effect on this is really interesting. It's almost circular that, you know, offshore wind is a solution to climate change to reduce emissions, but also a lot of these questions that Bill White raised about how climate change is affecting these fisheries are also still being answered by the fishing community, by fisheries regulators. I mean, climate change is only just beginning to be factored into the management of some of those species. And, you know, each time they figure it out in one region, the species has just moved into another region where they have to figure it out all over again, as he pointed out, is happening with the lobster fishery in Maine. And so we're going to be seeing sort of a little bit of chasing our tail on that issue, I think, as it relates to offshore wind, because as we're trying to lower emissions, we're also trying to see how it's affecting the fisheries, how these solutions to climate change are affecting the fisheries. And
you have to make
system.
A judgment call. What's worse?
Right, exactly. And that's what I think is the most interesting to me about offshore wind is that it's almost like nuclear power. It's what are we willing to do to solve the emissions problem? What are the environmentalists and the marine biologists of the world willing to sort of accept as a trade-off? Is it, you know, it may not even be a lesser of two evils kind of situation, but at the end of the day, everything has effects on other things. And you know, these are the kind of big questions with these enormous projects that developers and coastal communities are going to have to answer.
Bill Quinlan?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think there's a balance that needs to be struck. If we're serious about moving to a clean energy future, we're going to have to invest in projects. The question is, what's the right mix of projects to achieve those goals in a balanced way? And by balanced, I mean one that's affordable, because we have to be mindful of rates, one that achieves our clean energy goals, and one that doesn't jeopardize the reliability of the service we provide to our customers. That's the sweet spot. I personally believe an all of the above approach to renewable energy development is what's needed for New England. And by all the above, I'm referring to offshore wind, imported hydro from Canada, small scale renewables, but solar coupled with battery storage. I think that's where this economy needs to move.
And potentially natural gas as a bridge fuel.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned battery storage, because we should talk about the intermittent nature of wind power in just a moment. But lots of listeners want to jump in with their questions, too. But Bill White, go ahead. You wanted to jump in real quick.
I just wanted to get, you know, we'll fire up the audience here a little bit and disagree just a hair with my friend Annie. And that is, you know, we can't, you know, it's not, you know, when you think about nuclear power and you think about offshore wind, it's not an apples to apples comparison.
Sure.
I mean, yes, every resource will have impacts, but we're talking about, you know, no nuclear waste. We're talking about no emissions with offshore wind. And we're talking about a resource that actually has the ability to create an enormous amount of local economic development. So I just wanted to kind of just dive in and stir it up a little bit on that point. You know, this is obviously a big moment. You know, the impacts to fisheries will be real. It will make it harder for fishermen to catch fish in these certain areas, depending on the type of technology that is used. But, you know, in Massachusetts right now, and according to the U.S. Coast Guard, which is really the authority on this issue, they basically have stated clearly that there will be no fishing restrictions within the offshore wind areas planned for southern New England and the New York, New Jersey area.
All right. So again, as everybody said, that's kind of a model for northern New England as northern New England now moves forward with some of this. Let's go to our listeners. Lots of questions. And Doug's calling from Barrington. Hi, Doug. You're on the air. Welcome. Doug, you're on the air. Good morning. Okay, Doug, I hope you call back. Let's go to Shelley in Antrim. Hi, Shelley. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. The other fellow is still on. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you are on the air, Shelley. Go ahead.
Okay. I just wanted to know whether the impact of infrasound is being taken into account or even looked at when the environmental impact statements are made.
Infrasound, Shelley, that's what you said?
Yeah.
Okay, what is infrasound, Annie? Thank you very much for the call, Shelley.
So I believe Shelley would be referring to sort of the you know, we can't hear them with our sort of everyday
with
ears,
our human ears.
Yeah,
sure.
the sub sound waves that are being generated by these turbines that might be affecting us in other ways, Bill.
Yeah, I mean, it has become an issue on onshore turbines, and there's been obviously concerns with houses located too close have been impacted. But if we're building turbines that are 14 to 20 miles offshore, you're probably not going to have, you know, significant impacts related to sound.
Well, and Annie talked earlier about the need for more studies on some of these impacts on the fish in that area. Thank you for the call, Shelley. And Doug is back in Barrington. Hi, Doug. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was one of the leaders of the grassroots effort that you mentioned at the beginning. We worked for several years to get the governor to act to request a federal task force, which he has done earlier this year. And it was a huge effort. We had 20 communities throughout the seacoast across the state do warrant articles and city council resolutions in support of this, and we think that there's just strong support, particularly on the seacoast. We were getting 70% or more response in the votes. So we think there is strong support. I'd mention, too, that every national environmental organization from National Wildlife Federation, Audubon, and many others have really signed off on offshore wind as being a huge potential, and that the environmental issues involved can be dealt with. I'm very confident that we can do this. What I wanted to ask your guests is whether they're familiar with the University of Maine Aquaventus project to do floating technology, and if they know where that stands. I know there are some issues with the PUC up in Maine, and whether we can work with neighboring states. There really ought to be a multi-state task force, as was done in Massachusetts and Connecticut and Rhode Island.
Okay. Doug, thank you very much for calling in. Bill White and then Bill Quinlan, floating turbines.
Yeah. So this is obviously a big topic. Obviously, the technology is still kind of not quite commercial yet. There is a number of pilots, shall we say, around the world. The Japanese, the Koreans, in Europe are all advancing offshore wind floating technology. But I think the caller is right on. I mean, the University of Maine is a leader in this floating technology. They have deployed a smaller version of what they're looking to build, a concrete floating structure that survived a couple of major storms over the last couple of years. So they are they have a very strong engineering team at the University of Maine. They have an ambition to build a full-scale 10-megawatt offshore wind platform off of Mohegan Island as a way to test and prove the technology. And they are actually one of the leaders in the world on this new technology, which, as Bill Quinlan said earlier, you know, we're likely to need this type of technology in the northern part of New England because of water depths. Anything really beyond 60 meters, the expectation is that we're going to need a floating technology in order to build in that environment.
Because it's just too far down?
Too far deep, and it would become cost prohibitive related to the amount of steel that is needed to go, you know, almost 200 feet to the bottom and then into the subfloor.
Speaking of cost, Bill Quinlan, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. Do you have any sense of how much offshore wind could help New England and New Hampshire specifically lower its electric rates?
Yes. So I think
realizing there's no specifics yet because we don't have a project.
Well, we actually do have a couple of data points from southern New England and just frame of reference. So, you know, a decade ago, we were talking about offshore wind projects like the Cape Wind project, which were over 20 cents a kilowatt hour.
And which is expensive.
Which is expensive relative to the wholesale market for power in New England, which is, let's say, 5 cents. So it's a high
premium.
It's
a big price differential. Right?
The Block Island Wind Farm, which is the first commercial wind farm in the United States, a 30-megawatt wind farm, which is very few turbines, relatively small, is 24 cents a kilowatt hour. So that's, again,
not including transmission.
Right. Yeah. That's
expensive. Pricey.
Now, however, Bill mentioned earlier the Massachusetts solicitation, first large-scale solicitation for offshore wind in the United States, because of competitive market forces and economies of scale, you're now getting much closer to wholesale market prices. Think of it in the roughly 7 cents a kilowatt hour range in a 5 cent market. So you're getting close to being at market parity so that you can deliver clean energy benefits at a price that's competitive with the wholesale market. I think you're going to continue to see downward pressure on the price of electricity coming from these projects as turbines get larger, as projects get larger, as we mature the supply chain, for example, here in the United States. Inevitably, prices are going to continue to come down to the point where this becomes a very cost-competitive clean energy resource.
Is that because, Bill, just more people around the world are doing it? And so as
yes.
more people do it, you have more suppliers, builders, people with expertise, so the price goes down.
Exactly. And again, it's a mature industry in Europe. There's a lot of projects that are in service. There have been a lot of efficiencies that have been gained. I think the key is to bring that expertise to the United States and develop our own supply chain, develop our own workforce necessary to put these projects into construction and in service. And I think inevitably, with experience, price will come down. So we're very excited about it. You know, I think this is a technology that holds great promise for affordability. It's very reliable, given the consistency of the winds in northern New England. And you know, it's clean, which I think is a big driver for the emphasis on the technology.
Coming up, a lot more emails. And also, I do want to ask all of you about battery storage, given that the wind doesn't always blow super hard. So we'll talk about that. Also, I want to ask about Europe and your experience there, Bill White. All that's coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Frank from Concord turned his Mazda into Morning Edition.
For this is NHPR News. I'm Rick Anley.
Erica from Bristol turned her Toyota into conversations with Terry.
This is Fresh Air. My guest, Emily Bazelon. She says, quote...
And Chris from Amherst turned his Ford into folk tunes.
A good Sunday evening to you, and welcome to the Folk Show here at New Hampshire Public Radio.
Before you trade in your vehicle, consider the value it'll bring supporting your favorite programs on NHPR. Learn more at nhpr.org/car donation.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. I'd like to invite Exchange listeners to a special live evening broadcast of our show on Tuesday, April 30th. The subject is education funding. We'll be live at 7 p.m. with an audience in our Concord studios. Go to nhpr.org to register for your free tickets for this special evening broadcast of The Exchange. Back to our conversation now about prospects for offshore wind in New Hampshire. And we're taking your questions and comments, your calls, 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, a couple emails I'd love to share. Julie in Guilford says, what are offshore wind builders doing to ensure the safety of migratory birds and also the health of the ocean floor and marine life during construction? Eve in Concord has similar environmental concerns. She says how much sound is produced underwater by the turbines. Eve says, I love alternative energy and would like to see pollution eliminated, but undersea life is suffering from humans and our noise disrupting normal behavior and even causing pain. So two environmental concerns. And Annie, this relates to something that you said earlier, the safety of migratory birds. That's part of that process that the task force brings together, right? The federal task force. You have to look at some of these patterns and where migration fits in.
Yeah, that's right. So like I said, the environmental reviews are a huge part of this process. I mean, these projects basically have to undergo the strongest kind of environmental safeguards that the government has to offer. And if they don't pass muster, they have to either be altered or they don't get permitted. And so that's part of why this process takes so long, is because they have to do these environmental impact statements and, you know, more specific reviews. They, you know, maybe have to agree to mitigations or to alter the project to avoid effects on migratory birds. Maybe I don't know if it's like the turbines shut down at certain times of year, if that can be something that we agree to, or if we move the turbines. But, you know, all of these things are something that the government studies as it looks at the feasibility of wind here in general and then at specific projects as well. And so the fishing community, the environmental community, scientists all would be, in theory, part of that stakeholder process, which is the sort of very, very first step that we're about to undertake right now in New Hampshire.
Well, concerns about migratory birds, and as we heard earlier, Bill White, also concerns about fish migration, which we don't think about as much, perhaps, because we can't see it. But go ahead, I'd love your thoughts, too.
Yeah, let me just hit the migratory bird issue first. You know, one of the reasons we're talking about going offshore is not only is the wind stronger and more consistent, which obviously is valuable for the energy creation, but it actually has very much less avian or bird impact. Most of the bird populations in the Northeast are coastal, you know, and beyond. We've done studies in Massachusetts to actually look at this south of Martha's Vineyard, south of Nantucket. And what we found is really beyond 10 miles, most of the bird populations are significantly less, some
that's
of the endangered
interesting.
Species.
So they're not flying that far out across the Atlantic
Ocean. That's right. So that's obviously a good thing because obviously that will be something that we'll want to avoid. On the fishing issue, you know, again, you know, I hate to harp on Massachusetts, but obviously given the experience there, you know, when we had this kind of federal task force, state task force, the state and I led this, what we call this fisheries working group, where we brought fishermen to the table to really get their input. And what we actually did is from the original planning area that we had, it was reduced primarily because of the input from fishermen by almost 60%. We really wanted to make sure we avoided some of the most important fisheries for them so that we can maintain, so obviously they can maintain their livelihood. So that was a big issue. But it's not going to be perfect. There will be some impact, I think, but that's the purpose of the task force, to bring people together and try to minimize as much as we possibly can the impacts for future offshore wind development.
Well, we played a little bit of tape earlier from Ellen Gaethel. Again, she's on the New Hampshire Coastal Conservation Commission. She's a marine biologist. We talked about some of her concerns about the impact of these projects on fish migration. Ellen also told us that she's concerned about wind turbines off the coast and the impact on the fishing industry here in New Hampshire, that it's so small. The fleet itself is small. The people work in very small boats. Let's hear.
They can't go far. They've always fished for what comes to them along the seacoast. And if you block it off with wind farms, there's no place to go.
So it sounds like these would be farther off. I mean, again, we don't have anything definite on the table, Bill White, but these would be farther off so that they would not impact.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is a decision
local close-in fisheries
for the state to weigh in on and obviously the fishermen to provide their input. But I think about, every vessel has a what they call a VMS, a tracking device, really, that monitors really where they fish. So the data exists about where the areas that are kind of most valuable to fishermen. And so, you know, as part of that planning process, that data, that information can be taken into consideration so that, you know, maybe you try to avoid some of those areas. But yeah, that's kind of the thinking.
Here's another question that came in from Joel, who says, what kind of local jobs would offshore wind create in New Hampshire and northern New England? And Bill, I'll turn to you first, but Annie, I know you've done some coverage of that, too, as our Seacoast reporter. Go ahead,
so
Bill.
I do think the economic development potential of offshore wind development is a big factor in moving this industry forward. If you think about the manpower needed to assemble these facilities, to install them, to construct the undersea cable, the supply chain necessary to support all of that development, the technicians who would operate and maintain these facilities once they're in service. Workforce development is critically important. We've been working very closely with organized labor, International Brotherhood of Electric Workers, longshoremen, and others who would play major roles. And there's a keen interest in developing that workforce here in the United States. Currently, it does not exist.
Well, that's my question. How do we know that some of these pieces of equipment would be made here instead of just shipped in from overseas where the expertise is?
I think for the initial projects that are going to be developed in southern New England, most of these components will be manufactured overseas and then likely assembled here in the United States. I think with time and given the number of projects that we now contemplate, I believe it's important that we develop that expertise here in New England. And we've actually got several initiatives underway with local universities, community colleges, and as I say, the local unions who would provide a lot of the expertise to build that talent base here in New England. Big part of the equation for these projects.
Annie, go ahead, and then Bill White.
So the last time I saw Bill White speak at one of our local energy conferences here, he said something I thought was really interesting, which is that for these larger turbines that you almost have to build a lot of the components close to the coast because they're too big to move over standard roads.
Yeah, they are huge. If anybody's seen some of the ones in the Boston area or in other parts of the country or in Europe.
Onshore turbines are enormous. I'm looking at a picture that our friend Dave Brooks at the Concord Monitor just retweeted, and it's of a turbine blade that represents about 2 megawatts of power being moved in Martinique, I think. And it's the size of like 3 houses, this one blade just
wow.
by itself. And you can imagine that, you know, you could theoretically move hundreds of those blades over I-95 if you had to, but, you know, it might be preferable to build them on site. I mean, I know they're doing a lot of that in New Bedford, right? And so
they're
or
building
the assembly
them there.
At least.
Uh-huh.
And
Not yet. But
that's the plan, though, isn't it?
Well, of course, Massachusetts. It's the plan for Massachusetts to have a blade manufacturer there. I mean, it's a significant amount of jobs. It's potentially 900 jobs associated with the blade manufacturer over a long period of time. But this is obviously an exciting part of offshore wind is this job potential. And I think, you know, I agree with what has been said. The one thing that for me is kind of exciting is that, you know, some new industries, you know, whether it's biotech or pharma, you know, it's pretty much an industry for PhDs. But this is an industry, yes, for PhDs and engineers, but it's also a blue collar and white collar opportunity because of the massive amount of work from scientists to operational engineers, from, you know, the whole kind of gambit of workforce. So it's not just, you know, let's say for the white collar. I think that's a, you know, rather exciting kind of opportunity for the Northeast.
Is onshore wind, Bill White, Are the turbines with onshore wind smaller than the turbines for offshore wind, or offshore wind?
Yeah, we're talking about a different animal.
Really?
Yeah, this is a we talked about some of the earlier offshore wind projects in Europe. ENBW North America, when we built our first, ENBW Germany, when we built our first project in the Baltic Sea, we used a 2.3 megawatt turbine from Siemens. The next project was a 3.7. Right now in the North Sea, we're building at a 7 megawatt turbine, and we just won a procurement for a 900 megawatt project in the North Sea with zero subsidy. So the largest zero subsidy project moving forward next, the middle of 2020. And, the turbine has not yet been selected for that. However, the expectation is that turbine will be likely 12 or 14 or 15 megawatts in size. And so one other thing back to the blades, just to give you a sense of scale. So usually when you talk about a blade, they talk in meters. They talk in, most wind turbine blades are 40, 50, or even 60 meters long. What GE is building for their 12 megawatt offshore wind turbine, they're building a turbine with a blade of 104 meters, so about 350 feet long. I mean, and back to Annie's point, you cannot manage those on our roads. We don't have the infrastructure. In Denmark, they basically have these rotaries, but they blow a hole right through the middle of the rotary so they can transport these wow. components. They've restructured.
I'd like to see that, actually.
We unfortunately won't be able to do that in the Northeast. And hence, back to Bill Quinlan's point, it's going to be our ports, whether it's Pease or Portsmouth or other ports in the region that are going to have to be developed in order to not only initially handle the kind of the assembly and construction of these components, but again, as this market develops here in the Northeast, and if we get to scale, it, as you said earlier, it's going to be more cost effective to manufacture those components locally.
Let's take another call. This is Andrew in Keene. Hi, Andrew. Thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
I have a question based on an earlier comment, and I know it's going to sound a little strange, so I'm going to do my best to get to this. You mentioned that the cables, once they go from the ocean, they go on the land to a substation. I'm just wondering what the size is of those cables and what kind of impact is going to be done to make sure that the power can get to the substation.
Andrew, thank you very much for the question. We talked about it a little bit earlier, but Bill Quinlan, you want to just remind us, these are not ginormous cables, but there is some disruption to digging them 6 feet under the ground.
And Bill, I wanted to ask also, it would be theoretically jet plowing like you're doing on the seacoast?
In all likelihood, yeah. Annie, yes, it would be. And, first of all, with respect to the interconnection of those cables with the grid, we would typically interconnect them into an existing high voltage portion of the grid. So the New England power grid, one of the highest voltages, 340 kilovolts. So we would look for a robust portion of the grid that could accept that amount of energy, and we would likely build a new substation to interconnect it safely so that the power could then flow unimpeded to customers. Typically we would continue to be below ground as you essentially approach the shoreline. At some point, you would transition from underground construction after you've made the landing to an above ground construction, generally adjacent to the substation. To Bill's earlier point, the ideal substation or interconnection point would be very close to the seacoast.
No, Annie used a term I'm not familiar with. Plowing? What was that?
Jet plow. It's the method of installation of cable. So as I described earlier, it is essentially a high-velocity water jet that creates a temporary trench on the ocean floor. You then lay the cable into that trench at the required depth, 4 feet or 6 feet, and then you allow the sediment to resettle on top of the cable.
It does sound disruptive to marine life.
It's a temporary disruption. The sediment goes up into the water column and then in most instances will resettle very quickly. It's proven in the industry the environmental impacts are modest and non-permanent.
And not much more than a thunderstorm.
I did want to ask all of you before we close out a couple more questions. And one really important one has to do with the intermittent nature of wind. And Bill White, I turn to you first, but anybody can jump in. One of the big critiques, as you know, of wind and solar is that the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. So How do you achieve those big gigawatt goals that you described earlier with an intermittent power source?
Well, I think it is a fair issue, and it's a fair discussion point. But I would say solar's capacity factor we refer to is really the percentage of time where those solar panels are producing energy at maximum capacity, you know, is rather low. So it's very intermittent. Onshore wind, you know, the best onshore wind locations and turbines, you know, maybe 25, 30, 35% of the time, are they actually really producing at max power? But an offshore wind turbine, what we're seeing, and particularly what we think we will see in the Gulf of Maine, given the extraordinary wind conditions out there, is we're going to see capacity factors over 50% and maybe even more as the technology develops. So it's a different animal, number one, and maybe comparable to maybe a coal-fired power plant that is producing energy at 60, 65% of the time. The other quick point that I would make is that, when we think about this resource, we often always talk about this hope for energy storage. So obviously, when you produce energy, you have to use it. There's really no way to kind of store it. Although this storage technology, these batteries, are beginning to be developed where, and the question really is cost also. So how can we make a technology that stores the energy so that when the wind is not blowing or the sun is not shining, we can fill the gap.
You can still access it.
Exactly.
Go ahead, Bill Quinn.
Yeah, I would echo Bill's comments. I think the capacity factor of offshore wind is significantly greater than onshore wind or solar. It is, however, still an intermittent resource, which does require balancing. You know, if we go back to our earlier discussion, I mean, the ideal complement is to have a high-capacity offshore wind farm with some baseload supply, like a coal plant, which generally are being retired across New England, or a nuclear plant or hydro, which are basically 24/7 around-the-clock assets. That way, when the wind is not blowing in the Gulf of Maine, we have a reliable power supply that we can lean on. I think it's also very complementary to small-scale renewables, and continuing to develop those, I think, is an important part of the mix. Storage is the game changer. So if we can harvest this wind potential, store it, and then use it when customers need it most, that's a game changer. I'll just give you one point on this. We have two large utility-scale storage projects that we are constructing in Massachusetts, one in Provincetown, the other on Martha's Vineyard, to essentially do what we're talking about here. And in very short order, we're going to be announcing some storage deployments here in New Hampshire to begin to use this technology in a way that really does leverage these intermittent assets to the benefit of customers.
So I'm sure Annie Ropeek will be covering that when that announcement comes out. I just want to close out with an email from Dan in Nashua, who says, I appreciate there's still some uncertainty around the localized environmental impacts of offshore wind. But Dan says there is no scientific uncertainty around the environmental impacts of not rapidly transitioning to clean energy. Dan, thank you for the email. And everybody here, we could have talked a lot more. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
A lot of fun.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.